R.B. Collins. News and comment. It's Friday, October 12th, 2018. When Alex Jones was booted from Facebook and Twitter, I said first they came for Alex Jones. Well, now they've come for right-wing news and an array of lefty news sites like Police the Police, Filming Cops, and Anti-Media. Yesterday, in a pretty sweeping move that is a body blow to our First Amendment rights, Facebook and then Twitter announced that many accounts are being arbitrarily removed. There has been no open process to evaluate if these sites have violated the terms of use at Facebook. And of course, Facebook doesn't have to provide any transparent or public process, because they're a private corporation, and they give away their services largely for free. And as it currently stands, they can do whatever they want with their service. And it appears that they are knuckling under to government pressure, perhaps as a way to avoid any regulation, or if regulation evolves, that will be on terms that the tech giants write themselves. So, Friday, front page story, New York Times, headline, Made in U.S., Untruths Infest Social Media. The right and the left try Russia's methods. Now, just these headlines are so loaded because the article focuses primarily on right-wing sites. But as I will describe for you in a moment, many of those in the center, on the left, libertarian, non-aligned, they have been swept out of Facebook, again, on an arbitrary basis with no notice. So the Times, by implying that the right and the left try Russia's methods, well, that underscores the unproven narrative of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. And I want to tip you off on Monday. I'll be posting a fresh interview with Gareth Porter, journalist and historian, who focuses on the data of the Facebook post from the Russian Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, and how that has been so heavily exaggerated in coverage, including recently in the New York Times. So this sub-headline, The Right and the Left Try Russia's Methods, really pushes buttons for me. So then they open the article by talking about how right-wing news, run by a blogger named John Hawkins, jumped on the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and posted information that the New York Times has determined to be false. And what they talk about, challenging her lie detector test and other issues, in my view, are appropriate commentary protected by the First Amendment, even if I don't agree with it. So the Facebook people announced that 559 pages and 251 accounts run by Americans, many of which, in the language of the New York Times, amplified false and misleading content in a coordinated fashion. Continuing to quote the Times, the company said it would remove the pages and accounts, and it said right-wing news had 3.1 million followers, and as if it was equivalent, taking down the left-wing Resistance and Reverb Press, which had somewhere around 816,000 followers. So the Times then quotes Nathaniel Gleischer, Facebook's head of security, without mentioning what he used to do, and we'll disclose that to you in just a moment. He was quoted here, if you look at volume, the majority of the information operators that we see are domestic actors, trying to calm fears about those evil Russian hackers and bots whose impact on American information and elections I find quite dubious, and that's what we'll air out in the conversation with Gareth Porter that will be released on Monday. So what's interesting here is that despite mentioning the Resistance and Reverb Press, right-wing news is the central focus of this story in the New York Times, and they link it to recent issues like the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. But there is so much more to this story. and we turn to the World Socialist website under the byline of André Damon, or Damon. And here we get much more honest reporting. On Thursday, Facebook removed some of the most popular oppositional pages and accounts on the world's largest social media network in a massive and unconstitutional assault on freedom of expression. With no public notice or accounting, over 800 pages and accounts have been summarily removed from the Internet. The removed pages include Police the Police, with 1.9 million followers, Cop Block, 1.7 million, Filming Cops, a reported 1.5 million. Other pages included Anti-Media, 2.1 million followers, Reverb Press, 800,000, Countercurrent News, 500,000, and Resistance, 240,000 followers. And it references that right-wing news was also removed. So, what's the reason? Well, Facebook said it was banning pages, groups, and accounts created to stir up political debate, referring to this as a coordinated, inauthentic activity. And I've got to ask a big WTF, what the hell does that mean? Coordinated, inauthentic activity? Who gets to decide what is authentic? Facebook went on to say, these pages use sensational political content to build an audience and drive traffic to their websites. Tellingly, the social media monopoly added that the pages are often indistinguishable from legitimate political debate. Facebook said the pages were targeted for their behavior, including operating multiple accounts and posting clickbait. These half-hearted efforts, says the author here, André Damon, these half-hearted efforts to deny that it's targeting oppositional Facebook pages with unsubstantiated allegations about their behavior are a transparent lie. The New York Times quoted a man named Ryan Fox, identified as a co-founder of New Knowledge, a firm that tracks disinformation. But the World Socialist website informs us that Fox previously worked for the NSA and the U.S. Joint Special Operation Command. The CEO of that company, New Knowledge, Jonathan Morgan, is connected to the Brookings Institution and was previously a special advisor to the State Department. The article continues here. Facebook and other companies are deciding what constitutes well-developed networks seeking to manipulate public opinion. The targets mainly are left-wing organizations. Censorship by social media monopolies has been instigated by leading figures within the U.S. government, including Democratic Senators Mark Warner and Dianne Feinstein and Congressman Adam Schiff, who have demanded that the companies suppress divisive content in repeated hearings of the House and Senate Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. An internal Google document leaked on Tuesday admitted that tech firms have gradually shifted away from unmediated free speech and toward censorship. And let's keep in mind that Facebook in particular has achieved its profits, its value, by exploiting user-generated content that we give them for free. And they presented the idea that this is a forum where we can express ourselves in a liberated manner. And I haven't been notified of a change in the terms of service, but clearly a change has occurred. And the outspoken Caitlin Johnstone, the Australian woman who writes credibly about American politics, she posted at Anti-Media, where apparently she has been publishing for a while. And she quotes this guy, Gleicher, who I mentioned earlier, Nathaniel Gleicher or Gleicher, who is the former White House National Security Council Director of Cybersecurity Policy. Isn't it nice to know that these big brothers have a background working in the spook zone of our government? Johnstone continues, the inauthentic behavior, according to Facebook, consists of using sensational political content, regardless of its slant, to build an audience and drive traffic to their websites, which, she says, is the same as saying they write about controversial things and posting those political articles in dozens of Facebook groups, often hundreds of times in a short period, drums up traffic for their websites. In other words, Johnstone translates for us, the pages were removed for publishing controversial political content and trying to get people to read it. Not for writing fake news, but for doing what they could to get legitimate indie media news stories viewed by people who might want to view it. And how does this differ from what the New York Times, BuzzFeed, TMZ? They use all kinds of tricks to get you to click and look at videos, look at articles. Misleading headlines, pandering headlines, or subject lines that get you to say, oh, this is for me. One of the people affected ran noisyroom.net, Teresa Munro Hamilton. For those of you who read what I write, you know what I did not violate any standards. In fact, I don't send out most of what I write. I send on big news links and a few memes. It was enough to get me banned, and the pages are simply gone. Facebook took down my page with nearly 70,000 followers, labeling it as spam, when I have spent 4 years working to build that page up and using it to post the articles I wrote and videos of my reporting. And RT, the Russian-owned media outlet that does operate in the United States, has an audience just about this big. They are once again banned from Facebook after being kind of downgraded in the past. But all kinds of other propaganda, and I'll call RT propaganda. It's not all propaganda, but it's viewed that way because of who it comes from. But the BBC is okay. Anything coming from the Israeli government is trustworthy. The United States government is given great deference. Despite the packs and packs and packs of lies that it pumps out on a daily basis. So this is indeed a turning point. This is a critical moment for free speech rights in the digital era. And one of my smart Facebook friends, Jay Cryer, writes, "This is the silencing of legitimate dissent, pure and simple. The anti-media site is not fake news. They never spammed me and had lots of good and truthful stories and some stupid ones. But they always had hyperlinks to the sources, same with the Free Thought Project. It's bullshit and it's scary. They've both been booted from both Facebook and Twitter. I don't love all their stories or opinions, but they are legitimate news sites. It is definitely time to abandon Facebook. They're going after solid, real news pages, but apparently ones that the Atlantic Council and the National Review don't approve of. If anyone can pull together an exodus, I'm in. Until then, or until I'm booted, I guess I'll keep bitching about the boss on the boss's platform." And by the way, this may pass as good news on a day like this for Facebook. The hack that was announced, 2 weeks ago, estimated at 50 million users? You may be relieved to know that the number is only 30 million. But they are confirming that the hackers had access to users' emails, phone numbers, and the other personal information that you have given to Facebook. As I mentioned, Monday we will post our new interview with Gareth Porter about the use of Facebook and Twitter, the alleged meddling in our 2016 election by Russia, and how the New York Times and other media outlets have badly hyped and really conducted media malpractice in the process. But today I'm releasing a fresh, in-depth interview with Emily Johnston. And I congratulated her on being acquitted after heavy charges were brought in state court in Minnesota for her coordinated activity with the other valve turners. 2 years ago this week, they went to 5 different locations where pipelines bring tar sands crude from Canada into the United States. And after notifying Enbridge or the other operators by phone, they went into these facilities and they cut some chains and they turned off the valves. Well, in this court proceeding in Minnesota, Emily Johnston tells us that they were shocked a week ago when the judge who had permitted their so-called necessity defense, where they're claiming that they had to take this action because the warming of the planet is such a critical issue. It's an emergency. Well, the judge thwarted their plans to present that necessity defense by not allowing their expert witnesses to testify. And then the judge surprised everyone on Tuesday by announcing that the government had not proved its charges that there was no damage caused by these protesters, and he acquitted them on all counts. He threw out the case. Now, as you can imagine, Emily Johnston is relieved that she doesn't have to face going to prison. But she's deeply disappointed that they don't get to bring their necessity defense to begin to establish it as a precedent for other protest activities. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Emily Johnston.
We did establish a couple of precedents, which is great. One is that when the judge granted us the necessity defense, he did so in writing, so that's citable, and other states and places can rely on that as a reasoning for them doing it. The other is that the state's highest court upheld that. And so, like, it going through the system and being continually appealed and having those appeals rejected is also important. So we did accomplish something in the judicial system, but what I would have really liked is for our witnesses to be on the stand, for the jury to be able to hear all that, and for people to come away from that trial disturbed and unsettled by what they had learned about climate change and by the fact, perhaps, that a fairly conservative Minnesota jury had either had a hung jury or acquitted us, perhaps, as a result. That would have been sort of earth-shaking news within the legal realm, and that would have been really important.
You can hear the full interview with Emily Johnston, the valve turner and poet. I'm releasing it today to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com. You can find it on iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher, and just about every place. It's not on YouTube. The in-depth interviews don't go onto YouTube for various reasons. Surprised today as a Turkish court ordered the release of an American man who has been the center of controversy and a push-pull from the U.S. and Turkey. Pastor Andrew Brunson has been released from house arrest and all judicial restrictions on him have been lifted. He is expected to leave Turkey in the next 24 hours and expect that the U.S. and the Trump administration will grandstand on this and try to exploit it for political gain in the midterm election. What I don't know is if there is a backroom deal to trade Reverend Brunson for Fethullah Gulen. Gulen is this murky figure, very powerful in Turkey, seen as kind of the Antichrist by the Erdogan supporters. He's blamed for the attempted coup 3 years ago. 2 years ago, sorry, 2016. And this led to this massive purge that also dragnetted Andrew Brunson. And I wouldn't be surprised if in a few weeks we learn that Gulen is being returned to Turkey. Now, Turkey is also the scene of a crime, alleged, at the Saudi consulate, where the American resident Jamal Khashoggi entered and never left. It is believed that he was murdered by a team of assassins who had been flown in from Saudi Arabia the same day. And this is turning into a big international kerfuffle. There's a big conference set up by the Saudi, an investment fund, and a lot of Americans were planning to attend, and many of them are backing out. And what this exposes is the deep grip that the wealthy Saudi royal family has on many American businesses. They're deeply invested in real estate here. I don't know if they still own the Fairmont Hotel chain, but I believe they did for a while. And get this, Uber, $3.5 billion of Saudi investment from their public investment fund. Tesla, $2 billion. Lucid Motors, another electric car company, $1 billion. Magic Leap, which is augmented reality, got a $461 million investment from Saudis in March. Twitter, $300 million. Snap, $250 million. Lyft, $247 million. So there is a lot of influence that is being, I think, leveraged, both for and against the Saudi family, the royals, over this incident, the disappearance at minimum of Mr. Khashoggi. So the Future Investment Initiative to be held in Riyadh later this month at the Hyatt, It was turned into a prison for wayward members of the Saudi royal clan who were held there indefinitely by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Would you want to go to a conference at a Hyatt that was most recently used as a prison for the world's wealthiest people? Also in the region, another bloody day in Gaza, as 6 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces. 4 of them were killed in one location. The Israeli military said it opened fire on Palestinians who breached the fence and approached an army post. As many as 15,000 Palestinians were protesting today, and at least 140 were wounded today. The death count since these marches began in May, I think it was before that, maybe it was in April, is 150 to date. And in May, on a single day, 60 protesters were killed along the Gaza border. The nation of Malaysia has surprised us by announcing that capital punishment will be abolished. The country's minister of law quoted, "All death penalty will be abolished, full stop." Yesterday, too, the state of Washington, through its Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, ended the application of the death penalty in the state of Washington. I believe they are the 14th state now to ban capital punishment. The Pentagon has ordered the grounding of its fleet of F-35 strike fighter jets a few weeks after one of them crashed in South Carolina. Now, these are the planes that never should have been deployed, much less built. But we have a fleet of over 200 of these extremely expensive, over $100 million per unit. And they have been plagued by problems all the way along the funding and the development process. They're telling us that the initial data from the crash near Beaufort, South Carolina, points to problems with the fuel tubes. That accident occurred on September 28th. Over at the White House, Stephen Miller is scheming for a kinder, gentler hostage plan for those who cross our southern border in a family configuration. Now, we haven't seen much reporting on this, but the number of people, family members, arrested and charged with illegally crossing the border jumped 38% in August. Now, clearly, the repulsive reaction of many Americans and the crackdown by the courts on this policy that was based on a misguided zero-tolerance plan, and there was no way that they actually organized this. They didn't keep track of the kids they separated from their parents. I mean, the level of negligence and intentional negligence by our government in this episode is hard to put into words. So Stephen Miller now has an option called binary choice. This would offer families who get arrested together to stay in detention as a group for up to 20 days, and at the end of that, give parents a choice. You can stay in family detention with your children for months or years as your immigration case proceeds, or you can allow the children to be taken to a government shelter so other relatives or guardians can seek custody. It's not clear whether those parents would then be immediately deported. But this is just another way to create a new set of hostages. And Stephen Miller has acknowledged, just like Hillary Clinton has in the past, that treating people who arrive at our borders in a brutal manner is intended to send a message to those who have not yet attempted to come to the United States, hoping to persuade them to stay where they are, no matter what conditions they're living in. Stephen Miller is advocating for these tough measures because he believes the springtime separations worked as an effective deterrent to illegal crossings. Now, some in the White House, according to the Washington Post, are concerned about the optics and political blowback of renewed separations. But Miller and others are determined to act, I imagine it'll await the passage of the midterm elections, and then a lot of dirt's going to fly. That's what I expect. Trump administration is also scheming to try to limit or eliminate those pesky, noisy protests outside the White House. Now, Trump has often talked about the idea of paid protesters. Most recently, the George Soros was paying people to protest the Kavanaugh nomination. He doesn't understand that those of us who oppose him don't require compensation to express that. But because he packs his rallies, and we know he packed his initial announcement of running for president at Trump Tower with paid extras, just like he had on The Apprentice. Well, I do consider it a form of projection. Anyway, to try to reduce the number of people who congregate outside the White House, Ryan Zinke, the Interior Director, and he's nominally over the U.S. Park Service that controls the Capitol Mall and other facilities there, he is proposing to close 80% of the sidewalks around the White House and has suggested that protesters or other groups who assemble could be charged event management costs for First Amendment-covered demonstrations. Currently, the Park Service is able to recoup costs for special events, but not spontaneous protests like the ones typically taking place in Lafayette Park across from the White House. These charges could include the cost of erecting barriers, cleaning fees, repairs to grass, permit fees, salaries of personnel on hand to monitor demonstrations, all tallied at the discretion of the police. Just another way that the creeping police state and totalitarian measures are gripping these United States. And I guess this interview on ABC scheduled for tonight with Melania Trump may have some interesting elements. Yesterday, she announced that she may be the most bullied person in the world. Okay, I think that exaggerates both your importance and your level of victimization. But the interviewer asked her if she loves her husband, and her answer was kind of remote and chilly. Yes, we are fine. Yes. She played down a suggestion that the repeated rumors of his philandering had put a strain on their marriage. It is not concern and focus of mine, she said. I'm a mother and a first lady, and I have much more important things to think about and to do. When she was asked if the repeated rumors had hurt her, she paused and then reiterated, the media world is speculating. Yeah, it's not always pleasant, of course. But I know what is right and what is wrong and what is true and what is not true. Okay. You believe Stormy? And finally, we have to give Jason Leopold credit for being the FOIA fiend that he has developed a reputation for. The most recent disclosure that he got from the government was a bunch of emails from John Kelly when he was running the Department of Homeland Security before he was brought into the White House to replace the totally ineffective Reince Priebus as chief of staff. So yesterday, Jason Leopold published an email exchange that followed an interaction that John Kelly had with Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who is tagged as Pocahontas when Trump wants to put her down in front of his mob rallies. Well, Warren had demanded answers about the travel ban, about the people who were stacked up at Boston's Logan International Airport, that's in her state. And so following their meeting on February 8 of 2017, Kelly wrote to an assistant, "What an impolite, arrogant woman. She immediately began insulting our people, accusing them of not following the court order, insulting and abusive behavior toward those covered by the pause. Blah, blah, blah." Well, once again, this is one of those statements by an arrogant White House official that he will live to regret. I'm sure that John Kelly's not a big fan of the Freedom of Information Act either. There's already a website reserved for ImpoliteArrogantWoman.com. And you may recall that Senator Warren was shushed and lectured by Senate Leader Mitch McConnell when she criticized Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions from the Senate floor. And McConnell used the phrase, nevertheless, she persisted. So if Elizabeth Warren is serious about running for president in 2020, and I take her seriously on domestic issues, not so much on foreign policy, well, she's got a couple of phrases that are going to resonate with her supporters. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. I'm glad you did. You can share it far and wide, and you'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.